From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, as Easter approaches, we take a look at the history of crucifixion and the crucifixion of Jesus. We talk with John Dominic Crossan, who describes his work as combining faith and history. He's a former monk in the Servite Order and the former co-chair of the Jesus Seminar, a group of scholars who tried to reconstruct the life and times of Jesus from the historical evidence. Crossan's books include Jesus, A Revolutionary Biography, and Who Killed Jesus? He's a professor emeritus of religious studies at DePaul University. John Dominic Crossan, coming up on Fresh Air.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Frank Stachow. In Iraq today, U.S. Chief Administrator Paul Bremer said the deaths and mutilation of four American contractors in Fallujah yesterday will not go unpunished. And a U.S. general vowed to, quote, pacify the Iraqi city. Meanwhile, NPR's Ivan Watson reports there was more anti-American violence in the area today.
U.S. military spokesmen say three U.S. soldiers were injured when a military convoy was attacked on its way out of Baghdad in the direction of the western town of Fallujah. There were video pictures then broadcast on Arabic news channels of an abandoned Humvee where Iraqis were looting the vehicle and then setting fire to it. This occurring near Fallujah, where there was an unprecedented display of hatred for the U.S. occupation yesterday.
NPR's Ivan Watson in Baghdad. Energy Secretary Spencer Abraham told a House panel that President Bush has been urging OPEC nations not to implement production cuts that would further drive up the price of gasoline. Democratic Congressman Ed Markey of Massachusetts questioned Abraham during the hearing.
The American consumer is being tipped upside down by OPEC, with money being shaken out of their pockets every day at the gas pump. And it's going to have a profound impact on the American economy. So I think the American public has a right to know whether or not we did jawbone these leaders. Which of the OPEC leaders, Mr. Secretary, have you personally asked not to turn off the spigots of oil?
I have been in contact on a regular basis with the leaders of most of the OPEC countries on these issues.
But Abraham declined to say whether the administration has been specifically pressing Saudi Arabia, which led the move to cut production by a million barrels a day. The White House lost another battle as it fights to protect the confidentiality of records from Vice President Dick Cheney's Energy Task Force. The task force met secretly in 2001 to design a national energy policy, and ever since, critics have been in court looking for evidence that industry lobbyists helped write the policy. NPR's Peter Overby reports.
A separate lawsuit against the administration has ended up with some fanfare at the Supreme Court, but environmentalists say this case could actually produce more information about the task force. Cheney's task force got its staff from the Energy Department and other agencies. Legally speaking, the Natural Resources Defense Council and the watchdog group Judicial Watch are invoking the Freedom of Information Act, arguing that it applies to task force records held by the agencies. The administration contends that the documents are protected because they're at the White House, which is exempt from the disclosure law. Federal District Judge Paul Friedman rejected that defense. He gives the agencies until June 1st to turn over the relevant documents. There's no word yet from the Justice Department about a possible appeal. Peter Overby, NPR News, Washington.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average rose 15 points. The Nasdaq was up 20. The S&P 500 gained nearly 6 points. You're listening to NPR News. The Defense Department is reporting that so far 522 military personnel serving in the Persian Gulf region have contracted a severe parasitic skin infection. NPR's Brenda Wilson reports.
69% of the confirmed cases of leishmaniasis were in soldiers who developed skin lesions after spending time in northern Iraq, where the sandfly, which carries the parasite, is endemic. The greatest number of cases were reported in August through November last year, during the peak of Iraq's summer. Although all services were affected, members of the Army active on the ground had the highest number of cases. The infection is not always detected, but the Defense Department is now conducting awareness campaigns improving soldiers' living conditions, and emphasizing the need to use insecticide-treated bed nets and clothing. If not treated, leishmaniasis can lead to wasting, anemia, and chronic skin conditions. Brenda Wilson, NPR News.
U.S. diplomats met with Palestinian officials today in an effort to revive the Bush administration's Middle East roadmap. The American envoy said that Israel's plan to pull out of the Gaza Strip brings an opportunity for peace, but they said future progress would depend on a Palestinian crackdown on militants. The Americans delivered the message in a meeting with Palestinian Prime Minister Ahmed Kerea in the West Bank town of Jericho. The team then spent 2.5 hours in talks with Prime Minister Ariel Sharon, but no details were disclosed. 3 Miami police officers were convicted today on charges they were part of a cover-up to protect fellow officers who fatally shot 2 unarmed robbers. Lieutenant Israel Gonzalez and Officer Jorge Garcia face up to 10 years in prison for perjury and obstructing justice. Sergeant Jose Quintero faces 5 years. I'm Frank Stacio in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Sodexo, acknowledging our employees' efforts to stop hunger in our communities during April's Sodexo Servathon. HelpStopHunger.org.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by BBC America, presenting The Office, the innovative British comedy about the banality of 9 to 5 in excruciating detail, Thursday nights at 10 on BBC America.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Easter is coming, celebrating the resurrection of Jesus Christ after his crucifixion. His scourging and crucifixion is the focus of the Mel Gibson film, The Passion of the Christ. We're going to take a historical look at crucifixion, which was a widespread form of punishment in antiquity. My guest, John Dominic Crossan, is professor emeritus of religious studies at DePaul University and author of the books The Birth of Christianity, Jesus, a Revolutionary Biography, and Who Killed Jesus? Crossan describes his work as combining faith and history. He's a former Roman Catholic monk in the Servite Order and the former co-chair of the Jesus Seminar, which investigates ancient historical evidence to help understand the life and times of Jesus. The seminar is controversial, in part because it does not take the Gospels literally and uses history to reconcile the different versions of Jesus' story as told in the 4 Gospels of the New Testament. I asked Crossan how long crucifixion was used as a form of execution.
Crucifixion was practiced as a form of, I would call it, state terrorism for centuries before it became infamous under the Romans.
And who practiced it?
Basically, the Carthaginians did it, the Greeks did it. It was one of the supreme penalties invented in and around the Mediterranean world.
Now, I was surprised to read in one of your books that there was, for a while, a Jewish practice of crucifixion. For what reason?
There's a difference between what I'd call living crucifixion and dead crucifixion. In dead crucifixion, the person is put to death. The criminal is put to death by, say, could be garrotted or strangled. And then literally the body is hung up as a warning, hung up dead, in other words. And there seems to be a tradition of that in some of the Jewish sources. The Roman crucifixion was living crucifixion. In other words, the person was impaled on the cross or on the stake while still alive and allowed to die in that position.
Now, who were some of the people that were typically punished with crucifixion?
In general, especially in the Roman situation, you can say almost definitely it was almost synonymous with the slave's execution. It was a warning to other slaves not to flee, not to commit a crime, not, of course, to kill their master or mistress. And it was extremely public. Its point was not so much the amount of suffering, though, of course, it was a horrible suffering, but it was a public warning. You were literally hung up like a poster. Don't do what this person did, or you'll end up as this person did. So very much for the lower classes and especially for slaves.
Now, you say that during Roman times, crucifixion was one of 3 primary ways of capital punishment. There was crucifixion, being burned alive, and getting fed to the lions.
The Romans talked about suprema supplicia, supreme penalties, and they really didn't calculate them in terms of the amount of suffering. They really calculated them in terms of annihilation. So being crucified, being fed to the beasts, as it were, are being burned alive, the function was there would be nothing left to bury. So even when they were finished with your corpse, the relatives, the loved ones, would have nothing to bury. There'd be no tomb where they could mourn, where they could come to grieve, where they could even, say, eat with the beloved dead. They wish to annihilate you and to do it publicly.
Even with crucifixion?
The theory behind crucifixion actually was that you would be left on the cross until you were consumed by wild beasts or wild animals. Usually crucifixion was low enough so that the dogs who would, of course, packs of dogs who would play in a place like that all the time, could consume your body. It was a form of annihilation. Now, we know, for example, that there was one case in the first century because we have found the heel bone of a crucified person with the nail still in place, and this person was buried, honorably buried. So it is possible, of course. It depends upon whether maybe you could bribe the guards or have enough influence to get the body given to you. Then you could get the body back. But in theory, the purpose of crucifixion was to leave the body there until there was nothing left.
Was scourging or whipping usually the first step before crucifixion?
In general, scourging preceded crucifixion, and the function of scourging, the primary function of scourging, again, was not simply to create suffering. If they wanted to, if the function of suffering was that the poor person would be kept in the barracks and tortured for weeks, the function of scourging was to reduce resistance. They did not want a person, for example, staggering through the streets with a crossbar, cursing Rome or fighting them all the way. What you wanted, this was public spectacle, what you wanted was somebody reduced to the state that the most it could do was stagger, as it were, to crucifixion, unresisting. So yes, usually scourging would have preceded crucifixion.
In your book, Who Killed Jesus, you quote a couple of the historic references to crucifixion, including the Jewish historian Josephus, and let me read a short paragraph that you quote by him. "They were whipped, their bodies were mutilated, and while they were still alive and breathing, they were crucified, while their wives and the sons whom they had circumcised in spite of the king's wishes were strangled, the children being made to hang from the necks of their crucified parents." And that's from the book Jewish Antiquities. I've never heard this before, that children were also killed while the father was being crucified and the child was hung by the neck of the father on the cross.
I think probably what you have read there is the most horrible example that we have in the whole of the ghastly literature about crucifixion. That women were probably crucified, I think, is absolutely certain. What was done to the children is probably best not even imagined, because the function of crucifixion, again, is state terrorism. And when, for example, the legions marched, they did not want to have to come back for one or two generations, so they made a terrible example of what they were doing to deter future resistance.
Here's another quote from Josephus from the book Jewish Wars. "They were accordingly scourged and subjected to torture of every description before being killed, and then crucified opposite the walls, 500 or sometimes more being captured daily. The soldiers, out of rage and hatred, amused themselves by nailing their prisoners in different postures, and so great was their number that space could not be found for the crosses, nor crosses for the bodies." Put that in context for us.
The context of that is the destruction of Jerusalem, the burning of the temple by Titus in the year 70 of the Common Era. And what is happening is either Jews who are trying to escape from the doomed city or who'd been captured after its fall. Josephus says 500 a day were being crucified until they almost ran out of wood. And one of the things that's emphasized there is that there is no definite way in which a person could be crucified. I mean, it wasn't that everyone had to be on a cross and the cross had to look like this. It could be on a stake, it could be on a tree, it could be anything that literally, and it's a horrible way to put it, but this is what they are doing. They are hanging up a warning, as it were, on the wall. The mutilated body of a crucified person had become a poster for "don't do this."
How does Jesus' crucifixion, as described in the Gospels, compare with what is known historically about the procedures of crucifixion?
In general, the crucifixion itself, and in a way the Gospel, has only one word. They crucified him. They don't describe the details that would show up, for example, in a play or a film. You don't have to decide if you're reading the gospel, does Jesus carry only the crossbar or does he pull a huge cross and upright already in position? It simply says it crucified him. Another thing it does tell you is that the crime, as it were, the claim, the alleged claim of being king of the Jews was the sign given that you'd always have in a crucifixion, saying this is what this person did. So the crime is, as it were, hung around his neck or attached to the cross in some way. But everything that's said about the crucifixion of Jesus would fit quite well into what you'd expect in the first century crucifixion.
And it said he was scourged and it said he was mocked.
The mocking is probably a separate issue. And in one sense, the mocking is terribly ironic because he's been mocked as a pseudo-king. And of course, any reader of the Christian New Testament, the Christian Gospel, believes profoundly that he was a king, far more than Caesar was or Pilate as a local governor, that their mocking was profoundest truth. So in a way, the Gospel spends far more time, if you count the verses, I think there's about four verses on the mocking, and there's only one single word in Greek for the scourging. They wanted to describe the mocking because of the tremendous irony that the soldiers mocked him as a king. I have no idea whether that is historical or not. They certainly could have, but the point of insisting on it is the irony that he was being mocked as a king, and of course, we Christians who are reading this gospel believe him most profoundly to be king, not just of the Jews, but of the world.
When did the cross become a symbol of Christianity?
Very, 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 very slowly and cautiously. In the time before Constantine, that is, before the beginning of the 4th century, when Christianity became more or less the official religion of the Roman Empire, you have very, very many mentions, of course, from Paul's letters on of the cross, of the crucifixion. But you don't see pictures of it. The very earliest one we have, actually, of the crucifixion is, again, we're back to the mocking. A page in the Palatine Palace in Rome was mocking a fellow page who apparently was a Christian. His name was Alexandros. So the page scratched on the wall of their dormitory, as it were, a model of the crucifixion in which Jesus is portrayed with the head of a donkey. And written underneath it is, Alexander worships his God. And probably that's the only way it would have been shown as a mocking of the crucifixion until after the victory of Constantine.
Have you thought about if so many people were crucified, if it was such a common form of execution, why did that become the symbol for Jesus Christ?
The crucifix only became, or the cross only became, the symbol for Jesus always, always, as accompanied by the resurrection. I mean, this is two things, execution, resurrection, mm-hmm. death, resurrection, always the two things. Because, of course, the point is that Jesus was officially, legally, publicly executed by Rome. It wasn't that Pilate made a mistake or that Pilate simply was rounding up people and he grabbed Jesus by mistake. Jesus was executed by the normalcy of the civilization of his day. Then, of course, when you say that God raised Jesus from the dead, you've got two things on a collision course. Rome crucified Jesus. God raised Jesus. Then the inference is very clear. This God we're talking about is on a collision course with Rome, because God had, as it were, countermanded the official decree of Rome. And so if you take away the resurrection, then the crucifixion becomes almost meaningless, or you have to get into another theology in which the crucifixion is the center of Christianity all by itself.
When you, as someone who studies the historical Jesus, think about the resurrection, do you think about it as metaphor or as actuality?
I think of it, I would not make the distinction of metaphor or actuality. I would make the distinction of metaphor or literal, because metaphors can be very actual. For example, the metaphor for me is that to claim resurrection for Jesus, and I can leave it completely whether you take it metaphorically or literally, either way, what you are claiming is that something has happened here which is going to change the way the world sees everything. And I think that is right, because the claim you're making is that God has reversed the normalcy of civilization. And that's why it's very important for me to insist that Pilate, from his point of view, got it right. He looked at Jesus. He said, this person resists our law and order, as it were, not a violent resistor, or had rounded up all his followers like I rounded up Barabbas's. But yes, he resists us, and therefore he must be publicly executed. Now, to say that God has reversed that decision puts God on a collision course with the normalcy of civilization. That, I believe, is actual, because I believe in what happened at the death of Jesus is that we were confronted with a warning that violence is going to destroy us. We got a warning that if you do not resist evil nonviolently, violence will destroy us. I think something did happen, because that was a warning, and we have not been heeding it for 2,000 years.
My guest is John Dominic Crossan, Professor Emeritus of Religious Studies at DePaul University and former co-chair of the Jesus Seminar. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. We often discuss religion and the history of religion on Fresh Air, not to proselytize or to favor one religion over another, but to help us understand the faiths that have shaped our world and the different paths religions offer to help us understand our place in the world. Our guests include priests, nuns, rabbis, imams, and Buddhist monks, as well as secular scholars and journalists. We hope you found these programs interesting and that you'll support us with a pledge during this fundraiser. Thank you. My guest is John Dominic Crossan, former co-chair of the Jesus Seminar, which uses ancient history to understand the life and times of Jesus. When we left off, we were talking about his interpretation of the resurrection. With the resurrection, do you think that there was some kind of physical transformation that happened to the actual body of Jesus?
No, I don't. I am completely convinced that Jesus had told people before his death that the kingdom of God has already arrived and that we have begun to participate with God in what I'm going to call the great cleanup. The fancy word for that is eschatological consummation. The great cleanup of the world, the attempt to make it a just place. I am absolutely certain also, historically I'm speaking, that people had visions of Jesus after his execution. They had visions. They are not hallucinations. They are visions. They are apparitions of Jesus. When they put those two things together, they said, then Jesus has risen as the beginning of the general resurrection. That's the only thing the word could have meant to them. It's not a personal, private privilege for Jesus. He has risen as the head of those who have died before him and as the promise of those who will die after him. I take that metaphorically. I do not take it actually. I do not think all around Jerusalem on Easter Sunday morning there were hundreds of empty tombs. And I don't think the people who believed in the harrowing of hell ever suggested, let's go out and check the tombs of the prophets to see if they're gone. I think they knew quite well what they were saying. They were saying something which they took metaphorically and which we take literally. And I think we've kind of lost the actuality.
Now, something that I find a little confusing, when we were talking a little earlier about crucifixion, you were explaining that for most Roman crucifixions, the dead body was left on the cross to be eaten by the birds of prey and by the wild dogs. And part of that was punishment for the family. The family would not be given the remains to be buried. There'd be no tomb. There'd be no remains. But the remains of Jesus is such a fundamental part of the Christ story. Do you think an exception was made for him, that there were remains, that there was a body?
It's utterly possible because of the Philo, for example, does mention the possibility of a body being given back to the family. And in a way, it's not so much a punishment for the family as a punishment for the person, because they're being annihilated. And we have the crucified heel bone of somebody who was honorably buried. So it is utterly possible that in an exceptional case, either because you bribed the guards or because you were able to get some influence, it was utterly possible to get the body and give the body normal burial. Now, the problem is that the Jewish law of Deuteronomy says by nightfall the body must be off the cross. I have no evidence, and that's, I would say, I expect that the Romans did not follow Jewish law, because the purpose of crucifixion was to let you die in agony on the cross. And if the person, let's imagine a case in which the person was only crucified by late in the afternoon, they would not be taken down from the cross. So the question is, and this is the question, is the story of Joseph of Arimathea in Matthew, Mark, and Luke, or of Joseph of Arimathea and Nicodemus in John, is that an historical record of what happened? Or that is that Christians' best hope of what they hope might have happened without knowing what happened to the body of Jesus?
So you think that the Gospels might be more about that hope than the reality, more about hope than journalism?
Here is the problem. When you look at Mark, Matthew, Luke, and John, the story of the burial of Jesus, knowing that Mark is the basis for Matthew and Luke, and that possibly, this is debated in scholarship, they may be the source for John. You watch the body's burial get steadily better. It's a hasty, hurried burial in Mark. By the time Matthew and Luke read Mark and develop the story, it's burial in a tomb in which nobody else has been laid, and they're explaining to you why Joseph of Arimathea was able to be a counselor for Jesus, but not against him on Thursday night, as it were. The story is developing, and by the time you get to John's account, the burial of Jesus is, I wouldn't even say royal, it's transcendental. There are so much spices used that they would fill almost the entire tomb. It's a magnificent burial. It's the burial of the Son of God when you get to John. Now, what happens is, as a historian, when I retroject that trajectory of a burial getting better and better and better, and I ask what was there in the beginning, it doesn't look very good. It looks to me like all they might have had at the very beginning is a hope that maybe some pious, non-Christian Jew, out of respect for the law of Deuteronomy, would have buried Jesus' body. But that immediately then raises the issue that they see, well, wouldn't he also have buried the two robbers who were crucified with Jesus? And wouldn't there be at least three in the tomb? And would it be a public tomb for criminals? And then how would we know which was Jesus' body? And so you can see them, I think, grappling with the difficulties of a story which I don't think is historical. I think it is their fervent hope, their best hope, that somebody took care of the body of Jesus. But none of that, by the way, in any way, is for or against resurrection, because resurrection is a new creation by God.
Religion scholar John Dominic Crossan will be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Coming up, we continue our conversation with John Dominic Crossan, religion scholar and former co-chair of the Jesus Seminar. We'll hear his thoughts on the film The Passion of the Christ and hear why Crossan is no longer a monk.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations. From Barnes & Noble, publishers of Barnes & Noble Classics, enduring works of literature in newly annotated editions, available at Barnes & Noble stores and online at bn.com. By audible.com, where you can download and listen to NPR programs like Fresh Air, in addition to audiobooks, magazines, and newspapers, audible.com/freshair. And from Stonyfield Farm, organic yogurt, and more. Erin Brockovich and Miriam Nelson will speak at the Stonyfield Strong Women Summit in June. Details at stonyfield.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with John Dominic Crossan, Professor Emeritus of Religious Studies at DePaul University. He describes his work as combining faith and history. He's a former monk in the Servite Order and the former co-chair of the Jesus Seminar, which turns to ancient history to understand the life and times of Jesus. The Jesus Seminar has been controversial because it focuses on history and doesn't accept the Gospels as literal truth. Crossan's books include The Birth of Christianity and Who Killed Jesus. I know that you've seen Mel Gibson's movie, The Passion of the Christ, and I'm wondering if you could give us your short review of how the Jesus story is told in the movie.
I've seen it twice, a month apart. I saw it at the end of January and again at the end of February, so I had a good month in to think about it. Basically, there's a couple of things that any passion story or passion drama does. You take the four Gospels, and there are four of them, by the way, and you reduce them to one. And then you reduce that one Gospel to simply execution. And then you reduce that execution to passio, the Latin word for passion, meaning suffering. So everything coalesces on the suffering of Jesus. Therefore, for example, there is nothing in Mel Gibson's movie, except brief flashbacks, more to increase the poignancy, about the life of Jesus. So by the time you come to the execution, and the resurrection, of course, is even more fleeting in this movie, you have no idea why anyone at all, would want this person dead, let alone executed publicly. You don't even understand it. Nor do you understand why, for example, it begins with a nighttime arrest of Jesus accompanied by Judas, who betrays him. Why was that necessary? Couldn't the authorities have grabbed him any time they wanted? Well, if you've been reading the story from Palm Sunday on, Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, as we would say, of that week, the crowd is all on the side of Jesus. It's said again and again and again in the gospel, the high priestly authorities are afraid to move because the crowd are on the side of Jesus. And in Mark 14, 1 to 2, they give up. They finally say, well, we can't do it during the festival. There'll be a riot. Then comes Judas. And Judas says, I can arrange it. I can arrange that you'll get him apart from the crowd at night. So what is not in this movie at all is that the whole Jewish crowd in Jerusalem is so much on the side of Jesus that it requires this nighttime arrest and an apostolic traitor to get him. And there's none of that in this movie. All the Jews that are in this movie, except for what I'm going to call Christian Jews, are people like Simon of Cyrene, who are converted into Christians. All the non-Christian Jews are bad. They simply are. And it doesn't work to say everyone is a Jew, because it's quite clear, for example, that Simon of Cyrene becomes a good Jew when he becomes a Christian.
When did passion plays become popular? When did it become popular to focus stories on the suffering, the crucifixion and suffering of Christ?
The emphasis on the suffering of Christ, almost the exclusion of everything else, is really very much a medieval idea and may well reflect the experiences of people. If people are suffering, and I mean seriously suffering, say with plague or something like that, or invasion, then to think of the sufferings of Jesus is extremely consoling. And the script that Mel Gibson used from The Dolorous Passion of Our Lord Jesus Christ, according to the Meditations of Anne Catherine Emmerich, is a good example. She had a life of suffering. She had a life of hardship, an Augustinian nun who spent the last 10 years of her life bedridden in great pain. And no wonder, of course, that she had an almost mystical union with the sufferings of Jesus, because she herself was in intense suffering. So the emphasis on suffering is, how shall I say it, appropriate, maybe even necessary for people in intolerable pain. Outside that, it becomes dangerously close to pathological.
What do you mean by pathological?
I mean, when you start to focus on suffering and the whole meaning of, say, Jesus' life being reduced, and that verb is carefully chosen, reduced to suffering, it is not the way anyone thought about it in the first century. The Romans did not compute suffering. They didn't say, we have to make this person suffer as much as possible, or they would have kept him in the barracks and tortured him for weeks on end. Their purpose was not suffering, but public warning. So when you bring it all down to suffering, it's very hard to show it without sadism. And that's what happens in this movie. How can you show 2 hours of unrelenting brutality and ask people to watch it and ask people to feel that they want it to happen because it's their redemption? So you have to be, as it were, on the side of the Roman soldiers. You have to want it. You can't even agree with that Jewish woman who cries out in the crowd, somebody stop this. You can't. You are being co-opted into collusion with sadism. And I think there is no evidence that I know of that the soldiers who scourged Jesus were sadistic brutes, as they're shown in the movie. They could have just been executioners doing their dirty job, wanting to get it over and get back to the barracks. So when you emphasize suffering to that extent, it is almost impossible not to slip over into sadism or even into religious pornography.
You know, when you say that the Romans weren't interested in sadism and suffering, they just wanted to set a public example, but isn't the whole point of the public example that you don't want to be the victim of sadists and that you don't want to suffer? So isn't it finally really about sadism and suffering?
It's a very delicate line, I agree with you. But did a person who was scourged and crucified suffer? Of course, of course. But, for example, by insisting on the public nature of it, they were insisting on their priorities. Their priority was not to make the person suffer. Their priority was to make a public example of this person. For example, if they scourged the person and the person died, they have failed. They have failed in their purpose. If the person simply died under the scourging, that's not their purpose. If the person died on the way to crucifixion, they failed again. They have to get the person to the cross, to die on the cross. That is their purpose. So, of course, there is suffering.
My guest is John Dominic Crossan, Professor Emeritus of Religious Studies at DePaul University and former co-chair of the Jesus Seminar. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is John Dominic Crossan, former co-chair of the Jesus Seminar, which interprets ancient history to help understand the life and times of Jesus. Crossan's books include The Birth of Christianity and Who Killed Jesus? Let me ask you about one of the key figures in the story of Jesus, and that is Pontius Pilate.
Okay.
What was his actual position in the Roman Empire?
Pontius Pilate was what could best be described as a sub-governor. He was the governor of the southern part of the Jewish homeland of Judea, Samaria, and Idumea. Antipas, Herod Antipas, was running Galilee. But Pilate, was under the governor, let's call him a first-level governor of Syria, who could hire him and fire him, as it were. Well, maybe couldn't hire him, but he could certainly fire him because he did. So he's a very ambiguous character. He is not really a full governor. He's a kind of a sub-governor. Secondly, He was in for 10 years, and most governors were in only for 2 years. He probably didn't like his job. He probably was fed up and tired. 10 years is a long time, even though, let's see, he came in 26, so the crucifixion was probably only 4 years into his tenure. The other thing he had to deal with was he was dealing with a temple state, as it were. He would be used to dealing with aristocrats like himself in any other part of the empire, but here he had to deal with a high priest. And he could, in this case, hire and fire that high priest. So it's a very bad administrative situation if the person that you must negotiate with in charge of the indigenous people that you're governing, you can fire that person. How do you negotiate with somebody who can fire you? So there's lots of problems with Pilate, simply from an administrative point of view, before we get to his character or anything else.
What do you know about his character?
Of all the governors, or all the sub-governors, if you will, of the Jewish homeland in the first century, we know more about Pilate probably than anyone else. Some of the other ones, we only know their names. But we know from the Jewish historian Josephus and the Jewish philosopher Philo a lot about Pilate. And what's really ironic is that precisely what they insist on, from Philo, for example, his gratuitous cruelty and his tendency to put people to death without proper trial, and from Josephus, his brutal way with handling even unarmed crowds, exactly what they focus on, show us a Pilate who is the exact opposite of the sort of a just person doing his level best to free an innocent person and just forced by this shouting crowd to go along with the crucifixion against his best will and just kind of finally giving in, maybe a little weak, but you know, trying to prevent a riot. That's exactly almost the precise opposite of what Philo and Josephus tell us about him.
Who were the Jewish priests in the time of Jesus who called for the execution of Jesus? Who was this class of people?
The high priests were certain aristocratic families, basically about four predominant ones, from whom the high priest was appointed, and appointed by the Roman authorities, by the way, not by any sort of election of their own people, during the first century. So, for example, the most important house or family was the house of Annas, because they had about eight high priests in about 60 years, so they are almost the dominant one. Caiaphas, for example, the high priest at the time of Jesus' execution, was the son-in-law of Annas, who had been high priest before him. And Caiaphas was in for almost 17 years. So the high priest would represent, as far as the Romans were concerned at least, the leadership of the Jewish people. And they had to negotiate with the Romans as best they could while they were really under the Romans.
And is there any historical information about how the Jewish common people felt about the priestly class?
It's very, very interesting that in Mark's Gospel, just to take that for an example, consistently on what we call Palm Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday of that Holy Week, it's said repeatedly, every day in fact, that the people of Jerusalem, presumably, are so much on the side of Jesus that the high priestly authority, who consider him dangerous and who consider that he might bring the Romans down on them like a ton of marble, as it were, that they are against him, but they cannot move against him because the crowd is supporting him so much. And in fact, in Mark 14:1-2, the high priestly authority finally say, we give up. We can't do it during the festival. There might be a riot in support of Jesus. So that, of course, is the reason why it becomes necessary to have a Judas who will locate Jesus at night, who will locate Jesus apart from the supporting crowd, and whom the high priestly authorities then can get under their control.
Historically, is there any evidence that the Jewish priests called for the execution of Jesus? And if there is evidence of that, what are some of the historical explanations for it?
The Jewish historian Josephus sums up what happened to Jesus by saying that the first men among us, that would be the leaders, accused him before Pilate, and Pilate crucified him. And I think that is the most precise and accurate summary you can give to the question, who killed Jesus? The high priestly aristocracy and the Roman leadership both agreed that Jesus was dangerous. And I think they both agreed he was not a violent revolutionary or they would have rounded up all his followers. They agreed that he was, however, what we might call a non-violent resistor against Roman law and order. And it's not at all necessary to demonize somebody like Caiaphas or to canonize somebody like Pilate. It made good administrative sense from the Roman point of view that Jesus could, unwittingly maybe, start a rebellion. He was talking about the kingdom of God, and as far as Rome was concerned, that was Rome. So Caiaphas and Pilate could have agreed without any problem that Jesus was a danger. But all the evidence is that the people were not on the side of Caiaphas.
So when you look at the question, you know, were the Jews responsible for the execution of Jesus? How do you answer that?
The statement that Jews were responsible for Jesus is an irresponsible statement. Some Jews opposed Jesus. We know, for example, that the high priestly authority under Caiaphas opposed Jesus. We also know that the crowd, that's the word that Mark uses consistently in the days before the execution of Jesus, was on his side to the point of opposing their own high priestly authorities. That has to be shown in any story that's even accurate to the Gospels. I'm not even talking about historical accuracy behind the Gospels. If you want to tell the Gospel story, you have to show that the crowd in Jerusalem on the days preceding, Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, are so much in favor of Jesus and so much in support of Jesus that the high priestly authorities almost give up, and it takes Judas, really, to give them the solution.
You were a monk for several years.
Right.
How many?
I was a monk for 19 years in a 13th century Roman Catholic order called the Servites.
Then you left the order and became a scholar eventually of the historical Jesus. Is there any way of telling us briefly why you left the order and then turned to scholarship?
I left the order for two reasons. One was to get married, and that was quite adequate reason all by itself. And the other one was, even if I could have stayed and got married, is that I was in constant trouble with the religious superiors, the Cardinal Archbishop of Chicago, because I'd been magnificently trained by my order to think. And as soon as I proceeded to do it, some of the conclusions I came to were not acceptable. And unfortunately, I've been trained to think and not to think under control. So there was a constant tension with my religious superiors in the Archdiocese of Chicago, not with the order.
Can you give us an example of something that you, a conclusion that you arrived at, or a question that you kept thinking about because you were thinking independently that was criticized within your order?
Well, in one sense, the final one was in 1968, when the papal encyclical condemning birth control was issued. I was invited to be on national public television, in this case in Chicago, and I said basically that I thought the Pope was wrong on this one, but as far as I was concerned, he was still the Pope, in much the same way as I thought the President was wrong about Vietnam, but he was still the President. And somehow or other, that did not seem to go down too well. But it was the truth. That's the way I felt. The Pope was the Pope, but wrong. The President was the President, but wrong. And that more or less brought down the Cardinal Archbishop of Chicago. Not my order, by the way, I say that again. But the Cardinal Archbishop of Chicago asked my religious superior to show cause why I should not be tossed out of the diocese within 1 week.
So you left the order under pressure.
Right.
But you stayed within religion. I don't know if you continued to practice it in the same way, but you certainly became a scholar of the religion. Did you want to keep practicing after that, or were you so disturbed by how you were treated that you wanted to just be a scholar and not a practicing Christian?
Oh, no, not at all, not at all. And I should insist, I do not consider at all that I was treated badly. There was lots of other people suffered far more because they wanted to remain a priest and had to leave, say, to get married. I had already made my decision that I wanted to leave the priesthood even if I could get married and stay a priest,
right,
because of the constant tension about theology. So I did not really have the trauma that some people did. And what I wanted to do was exactly what I did. I wanted to go to a Roman Catholic university, and I went to, if I may say so, a very great one, DePaul University in Chicago. Stayed there for 26 years. Never even considered moving. Told anyone that I had no intention of moving. I loved it. And part of it was the Roman Catholic atmosphere, but it was the Roman Catholic atmosphere in which I could think freely.
John Dominic Crossan, thank you so much for talking with us.
It's been a pleasure as always, Terry.
John Dominic Crossan is Professor Emeritus of Religious Studies at DePaul University and former co-chair of the Jesus Seminar. His books include Who Killed Jesus and The Birth of Christianity. This is Fresh Air. We often ask priests, monks, nuns, rabbis, imams, and religion scholars to reflect out loud about their faith and their studies. In doing so, we hear what nourishes them. Sometimes we also hear what troubles them. We hope you find these conversations interesting and thought-provoking. Today, your station is fundraising. Please call now with a pledge to support the programming. Thank you. When the Bush administration circulated some fake video news releases to promote its prescription drug plan, some people described the practice as infoganda. But our linguist Jeff Nunberg wondered why the word propaganda wouldn't have covered the idea as well. As he reminds us, the history of that word reflects the changes in the way governments have learned to spin the news.
The public has gotten used to seeing advertisers ape news show formats in TV infomercials. So the Department of Health and Human Services must have been surprised when the General Accounting Office announced recently that they'd be investigating the department's use of the same techniques. The department had sent to TV stations a video news release to extol the virtues of the administration's prescription drug bill, complete with fake reporters and a shot of President Bush receiving a standing ovation as he signed the bill. On Comedy Central's Daily Show, one of Jon Stewart's mock correspondents described that kind of bogus newscast as infoganda and worried that it might drive genuine fake newscasts like Stewart's off the air. And in the New York Times last Sunday, Frank Rich extended the word infoganda to describe the range of ploys the administration has used to spin news coverage, from the editorial direction it offered to Showtime's movie DC 9/11 and the mission accomplished photo op aboard the USS Abraham Lincoln, to the TV blitz by Condi Rice and others aimed at discrediting Richard Clark. Infoganda seems like a natural name for this sort of thing. It fits the pattern of those spliced together portmanteau words like infotainment and docudrama. I think of those names as genre benders. It's the media version of junkyard wars. There's nothing new under the sun apart from what you can cobble together from the stuff that's lying around the shop. But what's curious about infoganda is that anybody would feel the need for a new word to describe those government-produced news videos. There was a time when propaganda would have done the job all by itself. The word propaganda was originally invented by the Jesuits in the 17th century to describe efforts to propagate the faith. But it didn't become part of the everyday vocabulary until the time of the First World War, when the British and Germans began to use the new techniques of mass advertising and public relations to rouse popular support for their cause. Americans got into that game when the country entered the war in 1917. President Wilson set up the Committee on Public Information, modeled on the British Department of Information. It became known as the Creel Committee after its chairman, the journalist George Creel. The committee churned out posters, pamphlets, and press releases. It enlisted 75,000 people to serve as four-minute men who gave short speeches at theaters and public gatherings urging people to enlist or buy liberty bonds. Most of that material was pretty purple stuff, laced with phrases like bombs or bondage and if you don't come across, the Kaiser will. But Creel denied that the committee was trafficking in propaganda. Our effort, he said, was educational and informative throughout. No other argument was needed than the simple, straightforward presentation of facts. As time went on, propagandists became more sophisticated at disguising their product. In 1938, one New York editor objected to the deluge of phony press releases from the so-called news services that were set up by foreign governments to win favorable coverage. He warned that they threatened to break down the line of demarcation between news and propaganda, particularly if papers began to rely on them to fill their pages. But by then it was clear that propaganda was most effective when it masqueraded as objective news. In 1941, when FDR wanted to drum up support for tilting toward the British side in the war, he set up the Office of Facts and Figures, headed by the poet Archibald MacLeish. New York's Mayor Fiorella LaGuardia, who had been an advocate of the program, announced that the office is not a propaganda agency. We don't believe in this country in artificially stimulated, high-pressure, doctored nonsense. But in a private memo to Roosevelt, LaGuardia admitted that the agency's goal was to provide the public with what he called sugar-coated, colored, ornamental matter, otherwise known as bunk. Roosevelt's Office of War Information adopted the same principle in encouraging Hollywood to make movies that roused patriotic sentiments. As the agency's director, Elmer Davis, put it, the easiest way to inject a propaganda idea into most men's minds is to let it go in through the medium of an entertainment picture. Ultimately, the American propagandist's greatest victory was to discredit the word propaganda itself. By the time of the Cold War, propaganda only referred to what the other side said, and said crudely at that. The word conjured up the bombast and strident language of the fascist and communist, not the soft sell productions of our own side. Propaganda was stuff that played the Internationale in the background, not Stan Kenton. So it isn't surprising that the use of the word propaganda began to decline after the Vietnam War and tailed off sharply with the fall of communism. Over the last 5 years, it's been only a tenth as common in the press as it was in its Cold War heyday. That may be why people felt the need to coin the new word infoganda to describe the fake news shows and contrived photo ops that are designed to blend seamlessly into the media background. There may be nothing new about these techniques, but the current administration has used them more deftly than anybody since Roosevelt's day. And they found a fertile ground in the modern media setting, where the lines between journalism and advocacy and reality and fiction are already blurred. As a Department of Health and Human Services spokesman said in defending that fake news spot, anyone who has questions about this practice needs to do some research on modern public information tools. It's hard to argue with that. In a world of infomercials, advertorials, and docudramas, what's one more imposture?
Jeff Nunberg is a Stanford linguist and author of the forthcoming book, Going Nuclear. Please, don't correct me. That's the title. It's funny. Fresh Air's executive producer is Denny Miller. Our engineer is Julian Hertzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberto Shorrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Heatwave, Can't Hurry Love, and Reach Out, I'll Be There are just some of the songs written by the Motown team, Brian Holland, Lamont Dozier, and Edward Holland. On the next Fresh Air, we hear from them. Lamont Dozier has a new CD. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air. It's like a heat wave.